This is Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, is charity out of date? Should our watchwords nowadays be faith, hope, and economic justice? Tonight's guest, Dr. J. Edward Carruthers of the Methodist National Board of Missions. You speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call Collect from anywhere in the country. Night Call's host in New York City is Del Shields.
Good evening. The subject of poverty has been talked just about to death in the United States in the last 2 or 3 years. But one dramatic accusation about poverty has not been widely heard. The accusation is made by tonight's Night Call guest, Dr. Edward Carruthers, head of National Missions for the United Methodist Church. Dr. Carruthers says that the prosperous people of the United States are the keepers of the poor. And he means that we deliberately keep the poor in their poverty. Why do we do this? What are some examples and proofs? How can we break out of that trap and change our guilt-relieving kindness into true economic justice? These are questions you may want to put to Dr. Carruthers, who is standing by in New York City. Before I give out our Night Call phone numbers, I want to tell you something that may not have occurred to you. The sooner in the program you call in, the better the chance you have to get in with your question. So, if you've been disappointed time and time again when you try to reach us halfway through the show, pick up that phone right now. If you get through, you'll be able to hear the program over your phone, and we'll get to you just as soon as we can. You may speak to Dr. Carruthers direct from the East and Midwest at area code 212-749-3311, and of course you may call us collect at all times. That's calls from the East and the Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. You may also call collect from the West on area code 212-749-3357. That's calls from the West at area code 212-749-3357. And in the New York area, you may call us at 866-5010. That's local calls on 866-5010. Dr. Carruthers, good evening, sir.
Good evening, Dale. Good evening.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Dr. Carruthers, can you give us an example of how we keep the poor in their poverty?
I think I can be pretty direct about it. We like cheap food. People want cheap grapes, regardless of the fact that the people who pick the grapes don't get a living wage. We like cheap haircuts and cheap services. I think also we like to regard somebody as inferior, and it's nice to have some poor people around that we can hold in contempt, and this is a form of hate. I think also, Dal, we fear to make life easy and pleasant for people. We're afraid somehow or other if life is easy and pleasant that they'll turn out to be bad customers. In other words, we believe in cruelty as a means of producing loving people, and we don't do that way with dogs. In order to get a good dog, we love the dog and pet it, but we don't like to treat people that way. I think also we worship the mythology of being self-made. We hear people say, I made it on my own, let the other guy shift for himself. Well, it's nonsense. Not any of us made it on our own. We've all had a lot of help or we'd be in the gutter and out of luck. I think you could summarize it, Del, simply say that we keep people in poverty because we don't know any better.
With many of the charities and the foundations that have given thousands of dollars and in some cases millions of dollars to supposedly help the poor, was this money given the money funded to exact to really help or to assist, or was it to actually keep it as a status quo?
Well, I think there was a time in America when we had a lot of bleeding heart people that thought that giving their money away was really helping the poor. The churches don't think that anymore, and neither do the foundations. I have some contact with foundations and a lot of contact with the churches. We know that that kindness really isn't enough. Compassion, yes, we must always be compassionate, but perhaps compassion should lead to the kind of social change that leads to administrative justice. So I think the foundations and the churches now are committed to not generosity and kindness, but to administrative justice. By that I mean political and economic and social justice.
Dr. Carruthers, we have our first call standing by, and we'll take a local call from New York. Mr. Dan Jelly is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Good evening, sir.
Hello, I'd like to ask the father a question.
He's standing by.
Yes, Father, could you tell me why the ministers
don't actually go out to the ghettos and stay with the poor people and give up their life for what I consider to be absolute middle class.
Well, the fact is, we need ministers all over the place, but in the last 5 years, we are having more young ministers ask for positions in the ghetto where they can go and spend their life than we've ever had before. I think that your request is a very legitimate one, but I do think it's being answered. In the graduating classes in our theological schools, the men who want to go into the pastoral ministry, that is the local congregation, more than half of them in most of our schools, if you ask them, where do you want to go, they'll ask to go into the ghetto.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Right.
Somewhere I learned, Dr. Carruthers, that someone said that the poor we will have with us always.
Jesus said it.
Is that true?
Well, take it in the context. It was at a context where he was speaking about the fact that he knew he was going to be crucified, and he was complimenting the people on the fact that they were celebrating his presence with an expensive ointment. And I think what he was saying was that in spite of the fact that there are going to be poor people around, it's all right to do some expensive things, and I feel that way too. I think that's all it meant.
Mr. Savory is hearing Night Call in New Orleans, and he's hearing it over WDSU. Mr. Savory, good evening, sir.
Good evening. This is an interesting subject, and the example that occurs to me is the small loan companies at 3% a month when the interest rate that goes up from 4 to 4.5 or 5.5 to 6 or 6.25 is a big deal. At 18% or 36% a year is a terrific service charge for money, especially since frequently, if not usually, there is repossession of installment sales or foreclosure on the basic chattels that are put up as collateral for the obtaining of small loans with the excessive or critically high carrying and interest charges and so on. Thank you.
Thank you for calling, sir. Would you care to make a comment, Doctor?
Well, I think that the point he was raising is an extremely important one. We found some of the storefront churches in the ghetto paying up to 40%, 50% interest on money when they try to fix up the storefront to carry out community services. This loan shark business is a terrible thing in the ghetto. And one of the things the churches and foundations and the urban coalition together are trying to do is to set up in the ghettos banking institutions that are operated by the people in the ghetto to give a chance for poor people to borrow money and to borrow it decently. So I think that was the point he was trying to raise, and I think he had a good one. And I think that we need to move much more radically in the development of legitimate financial enterprises in ghetto situations.
Dr. Carruthers, the various sets and a series of poverty programs that we have in this country, are they a form of charity?
Well, some of them are. Originally, the OEO, the Office of Economic Opportunity, hoped to set up a national poverty program that would get the maximum feasible participation of the poor in developing for community change. CAP, the Community Action Programs, in the first year, represented the most hopeful aspect, as far as I'm concerned. Gradually, however, the prosperous people of the country began to be nervous about this because once in a while they would make a mistake. You know, we can tolerate a lot of error on a space shot that cost $5 million yesterday, but a $500 mistake in a poverty program makes a state scandal. As a consequence, the poor people were crowded out of the programs, and the prosperous people took over, that is, City Hall took over, and the prosperous people. And when they began to run it, then it began to be charity again. So my answer is, we had a whale of a good thing going in the first year of the poverty program, the war on poverty. But finally, City Hall and the prosperous people took over, and it began to have trouble.
Miss Johnson is calling in from Philadelphia. She's hearing Night Call over WHAT. Miss Johnson, good evening.
Good evening. I would like to ask the doctor who he is referring to when he says we. And what we don't do for the people.
Well, I'm talking about the whole United States.
Oh, really? Well, don't you think, Doctor, that it should start a lot with the ministers and the fact that they are assigned to churches from time to time and the congregation has to afford them with cars and a parsonage for their family and et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. I throw myself right in with the rest. I'm prosperous.
Yes. Well, that's all I want to know. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for calling.
This
is NyQuil in New York. Tonight, is charity out of date? Should our watchwords nowadays be faith, hope, and economic justice? And our telephone number is in New York, 866-5010. And our national telephone number for the East Coast is area code 212-749-3311. And if you're calling in from the West, area code 212-749-3357. Our guest tonight, calling in from New York City, Dr. J. Edward Carruthers of the Methodist National Board of Missions. Doctor, do we need the poor for menial jobs? Do we need them to serve as garbage collectors and street sweepers and what have you?
Not from my point of view, we don't need them. Most people think that a person doing a menial job should be paid a very, very low rate. But this actually is economically short-sighted. We ought to pay a living wage. The minimum wage laws are too low all over the country, and some states don't have any, and a federal law is much too low. I don't think that our economic situation either requires or justifies wages that are below the necessities of dignified living. Obviously, you can't have an equal wage for every job in the country, but I'll have to answer it by saying that I do not believe that there should be such a thing as an underpaid menial job anywhere in a country as rich as the United States.
Has the church been guilty of kindness without economic justice?
Oh, yes. Yes. You know, there's something about talking of love and compassion and mercy and gentleness that tempts one to forget how difficult justice is. Justice means, generally, a balancing up of conditions that are out of balance. It means some kind of social change. And it's much easier to express a personal relationship affectionately and with gentleness than it is to try to secure the change of a law that, say, maybe a majority of people favor. And this is where we're all locked up. Most of the people in this country are satisfied with the way things are. And when you get 60 to 70 or 75 or 80% of the people satisfied with the agricultural function, they're satisfied with how they get their food. They like cheap lettuce. They like cheap grapes. They like cheap peaches. It's pretty hard to change it. So what we try to do, we'll pick up the migrant worker and tell him a few nice stories on occasion and be gentle with him at Christmas and Thanksgiving. And with kindness, we somehow or other can convince ourselves that we don't have to go about the business of justice.
Mr. Wallace, who is currently campaigning for the presidency, is telling a lot of people that the country must get back to where it was. So I'm assuming that there are a lot of people who are not interested in the change.
Well, back to where it was never does become very specific, but let me go back to when I began my ministry in Colorado. The sugar company would bring in migrant workers from Mexico at the end of the harvest season. They would tell them that they had to go back to Mexico, but the workers by then would owe the sugar company for groceries and other items that they'd bought on credit, and I would go around with my little car picking up starving children in shanties out in the middle of the sugar beet field. Now, I don't want to go back to that. I had to turn the commissary of my church, the basement of my church, into a commissary. I had to get food and gather it up. I got a car of flour from the Red Cross trying to feed people that were almost starving. That was before we had any kind of a relief or welfare system. No Social Security in those days. Now, if anybody wants to go back to that, I just can't understand anybody who thinks or talks that way.
Dr. Carruthers, we'll return to you and to some additional calls from New York as well as Flint, Michigan, right after station identification. Stay tuned for the NyQuil Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Dr. Edward Carruthers after station identification.
The most obvious symbols of today's affluent society are the outdoor barbecue and the sports car. The most incongruous is the rat. According to the 1960 census, more than 4 million urban dwellings were completely dilapidated. 3 million more were badly deteriorated. And another 2 million had serious code violations or were overcrowded. If building codes were enforced, most ghetto buildings would be boarded up. During the 1930s, we saved the farms from starvation. Now the cities need help before they die of neglect. If you think there's nothing you can do to help, think harder.
Send for the free booklet, The Turning Point. Write Night Call, Pomona, New York. Speak for Yourself Collect on Night Call from anywhere in the country to Dr. Edward Carruthers about faith, hope, and economic justice. Again, Del Shields.
Dr. Carruthers, we'll take our next call from Flint, Michigan. Mr. Dean is hearing Night Call over WMRP. Mr. Dean, good evening, sir.
Good evening, Del. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I'd like to ask Dr. Carruthers this question. I was captain of the debate team at our college here in Flint last year, and our debate topic dealt very deeply with poverty, and I do agree that we are locking people into poverty, and I just wanted to get his opinion on the guaranteed annual income.
I'm for it 100%. I think it's not only an economic necessity, I think it would be a great economic advantage for everybody. There are 16 or 18 plans that I've read. I don't know enough about the details to advocate one above the other, but I think we ought to commit ourselves in national policy toward a guaranteed annual income.
Thank you very much, sir.
Right.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Del.
Back to New York this time. Mr. Harvey is hearing Night Call over WLIB. Mr. Harvey, good evening, sir.
Good evening, Dr. Carruthers.
Yes, sir.
You've sort of explained the poor's plight in terms of economic reasons. Namely, we like to have grapes that are cheap, and this is what the migrant workers' plight is. But it doesn't really explain why the poor fall into ethnic patterns. Is there some sort of social, psychological reason why the poor, why we keep the poor in their position? Does this make us feel better?
I think you've tackled one of the most difficult problems. A fellow by the name of Charles Valentine has written a brand new book on culture and poverty. And his position is that these so-called cultural or ethnic response patterns to poverty are defense mechanisms of some kind.
Uh-huh.
Just as you and I, if we're in prosperity, we have certain behavior patterns that relate to our prosperity. He says that once you're caught in poverty, that you begin to react defensively. I suppose maybe the simplest illustration would be that you begin to drink too much, or maybe you'll go after pot or something of that kind. So I think maybe we've got a problem here that we don't understand too well. I'll grant with you that there are certain habits or patterns of behavior that develop in ghetto situations that shock the daylights out of the suburban uptown dweller. I'm familiar with this because I get shocked myself. But I think if we relax a little bit and maybe conclude that poverty itself is the cause, not the result of those things, we'd be a couple of steps ahead on solution of the problem.
Well, but doesn't our social mechanism or whatever sort of perpetuate the poor for some particular reason? Is there not some kind of, I don't know, a yet undiscovered social psychological reason that the upper crust must maintain the poor in their position?
Well, I think it helps sometimes to ask who the poor are. For instance, 6 millions to 9 millions of the poor are elderly people, and they're poor simply because they're old. Now, only one out of five of these has a private pension. The number of the people, elderly people, in poverty is increasing by about 100,000 a year. We have several millions elderly living on about 50 cents a day for food. Now, when you ask the question, why are they in poverty? They're in poverty because of age. Now, we do have the female-headed families. 10% of all of the homes in this country are headed by females. That is, 10% of all of the homes that have children are female-headed. The husband is gone. Why did the husband go? Well, in 26 states, he went so the family could get some relief. So when we break it down and discover the young, the part-time workers who are part-time workers because health won't permit working, and also the fact that education limitations, about half of the people half of the people over 25 years of age in this country haven't been through high school. That's a shocking thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, when we get this pattern of who are the poor, then I suppose the reason they stay in poverty is because they get hooked into it, and these are called by a professor down at the New School as the poverty-linked characteristics.
Well, my question was more related to why the establishment or whatever it is that operates the society lets poverty exist. Why is it that our ruling people allow poverty to exist? Is it because of a fear? Is it because they don't want to share? Is it because of some kind of better than thou attitude?
I think I'd come at it this way. And this is an overgeneralization, but it's 60 or 70% true, that what would be required to bring people out of poverty would be some money. In a certain sense, the only thing that's wrong with being in poverty is you don't have any money. Now, a guaranteed annual income would give people a chance to get their chin up out of the ditch of poverty, but this scares a lot of people to death. On the guaranteed annual income just scares some people to death, fear they're going to spoil the motivation of people and all this kind of stuff, as if being poor was a motivation in and of itself. So I think maybe we keep people in poverty because the things it would take to get them out of poverty scare us. You get the word socialism or this kind of stuff every time you try to talk about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, sir. This is NyQuil in New York. Tonight is Charity Out of Date. Should our watchwords nowadays be faith, hope, and economic justice? And our guest calling in from New York, Dr. J. Edward Carruthers of the Methodist National Board of Missions. And we'll go out now to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mr. Muller is hearing Night Call over WAMO-FM. Good evening, Mr. Muller.
Hello.
How are you?
I'd like to speak to Dr. Carruthers, and I would like to ask him a question. What does he propose, or what is his solutions to the poverty that now exists in the United States?
I'd begin with income maintenance of some form. We're the only industrial nation in the Western world that doesn't have a family income maintenance program of some kind. I'd begin there. You might not want to call it the guaranteed annual income, and there are a lot of different patterns, but I would begin by eliminating the welfare system in favor of an income maintenance program. As a matter of fact, it's of great interest to me that the senator from Vermont, his name just slips me for the moment, has just introduced a bill in the Senate proposing that everybody past the age of 65, every couple past the age of 65, would automatically get $1,800 a year. This really surprised me coming from Vermont. I'd begin on the income base. Second, I'd take a good solid look at the housing program in this nation because there's no doubt in my mind but that we've got to move there. Let me just give you a quick rundown. I'd say housing, health services, quality education, job opportunity, and income maintenance. And I'd begin with the income maintenance.
Well, Dr. Carruthers, my position as an insurance agent is such that I deal with a lot of people who are on limited incomes.
Yeah.
And therefore, I run into this all the time.
Yeah.
Now, I find that welfare and all this other economic help that they are able to obtain doesn't really help the people. It doesn't make them people in the overall sense of the word.
I agree with you.
And therefore, I don't really think it's just to the taxpayer itself. Now, how can you justify this by saying what you're saying?
Well, let's put it this way. Are you against or for Social Security?
Social Security?
Yeah.
I'm for a person making his own way in life.
Well, I'd ask you the question. Are you for or against Social Security? Are you going to turn it down when you retire? You're on Social Security now, aren't you?
I'm paying into it.
That's what I mean. You're paying into it.
Right.
Is your employer paying into it?
Of course.
Sure he is. Are you going to turn it down when you get through?
But I've also set up I also have a pension plan.
Well, that's nice. I'm glad you have. Let's just stay on the Social Security angle.
Okay.
I'm going to take my Social Security when I retire.
Well, so did Eddie Cantor.
I have to pay all of my Social Security because I'm a clergyman.
Right.
But you're getting some of yours paid by your employer.
Right.
Now, I think you're justified to it. Let's assume now that a woman with a family was not able to earn when she was rearing her family. Why not give her Social Security while she's rearing the family? She's a member of the nation. She's making a contribution to the nation. She's working in the nation for the nation's welfare just as much as either you or I. Why not give her Social Security? That's all a guaranteed annual income is.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I really don't see your justification for stating that fact.
Well, I think all it does is it extends Social Security into the earlier years. You don't have to wait till you're 62 or 65 to get it.
I have one other point I want to bring up. You said that one out of five were on permanent income.
I said only one out of five of our elderly people past the age of 65 has a private pension.
Wouldn't you closer state that as one out of 20?
Nope. I said one out of five.
Well, according to the actuary tables and the latest results of any information from the insurance companies, it's based on one out of 20.
Well,
that's
you better...
One out of 20 are self-dependent at the age of 65.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about private pension programs.
Okay, that's what I'm talking about.
Well,
the rest are either dependent on their families or dead or some other means.
One out of five.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. You're saying one out of 20.
Right.
Well, I'm saying that one out of five has a private...
I'm putting the odds in your favor.
That's right, but I'm saying that one out of five has a private pension.
Mr. Well, Miller, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. This is Night Calling New York. Is Charity Out of Date? Our guest tonight, Dr. J. Edward Carruthers of the Methodist National Board of Missions. And we'll stay in Pittsburgh and we'll go to Mr. Coyle, who's hearing Night Call again over WAMO-FM. Mr. Coyle, good evening, sir.
Good evening, Dr. Carruthers.
Good evening.
Some of the big boys in government and labor have been talking about putting big industry in the ghetto areas. I'd like to know why management hasn't said anything yet, or very much.
Well, management has in some places. The Urban Coalition, John Gardner is the head of it, as you know.
Uh-huh.
And the Urban Coalition really has been talking about moving into the ghetto with industry. But I think there are a lot of questions as to whether that's a good thing or not. It depends on what kind of industry goes in, why it goes in, and whether it goes in as an outside force. Now, the ghetto people might have a few things to say about what comes into their community. The best sociologist, Gans, for example, points out that the Italian people in the west side of Boston, before they got all moved out, had a very deep loyalty to their ghetto community. And I think that what we ought to do is to ask the ghetto people what they'd like to have in that community, and then see whether or not industry would like to cooperate. I don't think you just want to move in with a big assembly plan of some kind and say, all right, here it is, we'll smoke you up and dirty you up and you can come here to work.
Make it a little worse than it is.
There's always the possibility that the people who already live there have got some plans of their own that are good.
You know, that's a different side of the story anyway. It's worth thinking about.
Well, I think the ghetto people have protested some industrial efforts. I know of one community that really resisted the efforts of industry to move in because industry was moving in to get cheap labor. They knew they'd come in and dirty up their area and probably cause it to depreciate further. So I think that while the Urban Coalition is with the churches, by the way, the churches are really cooperating in the Urban Coalition. Dr. Fleming, the president of the National Council of Churches, for example, is on the executive committee of the Urban Coalition. We're cooperating there, but I think anything that's done in this coalition of the churches, labor, and industry to move industry into the ghetto is going to, if it succeeds at all, have to cooperate with the decision-making groups in the ghetto.
Well, thank you very much, sir. It was nice talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Carruthers, we'll be returning with more calls and more questions and more comments right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Dr. Edward Carruthers after station identification. Night Call welcomes your comments about this nationwide listener call-in program. Your opinions and reactions are of value to the producers of Night Call in their continuing attempt to initiate and stimulate dialogue between the black man in the street and his white counterpart. Please address your comments to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. The producers of Night Call attempt to balance the points of view presented on this series about controversial issues. In keeping with this traditional concern for free expression on controversial matters, Night Call invites requests for equal time from responsible representatives on opposing points of view if it's thought they have not been adequately represented on the air. Such requests should be addressed to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. Speak for yourself, collect on Night Call from anywhere in the country to Dr. Edward Carruthers about faith, hope, and economic justice. Again, Del Shields.
And a welcome to our Night Call stations who join us for the second half hour each night. Our guest tonight, Dr. J. Edward Carruthers of the Methodist National Board of Missions, and he's calling in from New York City. And a reminder for our telephone numbers in New York, it's 866-5010. And our national telephone number is area code 212-749-3311 if you're calling from the East or the Midwest. And if you're calling from the West Coast, it's area code 212-749-3357. Dr. Carruthers, during the first half hour, we were discussing the guaranteed income. Is the guaranteed income, in a way, guaranteeing that a certain percentage of the population will not seek to go beyond receiving a certain income?
No, no. The proposal for a guaranteed income of some kind is a proposal that nobody in the nation will be allowed to sink below a certain income level. It would be different for the different sizes of the family. The idea is to make it impossible for anybody to be in poverty because of economic deprivation.
Well, the welfare programs were originally designed to assist those people who might have been in need, and I suppose to give some kind of assistance in the hope that this would help people to improve their way of living. And the welfare program hasn't quite worked out, has it?
Well, let's go back 35 years ago when the welfare program was born. The suffering in this country was just simply terrible. I remember it. I was just beginning my ministry. It was horrible, just simply indescribable. The welfare system was an invention. It was a tremendous social advance. But what is possible now by way of government and the handling of records and so forth with computers, you couldn't have had a social security system in those days such as we have now. The computer has made it possible. So that the welfare system, which was originally good and functioned quite well, has been outmoded now by the nature of our society. Therefore, we have to think up something else, just as we had to think up the welfare program when it was born in the 1930s. So now the time has come for an advance, and if the United States does adopt some kind of a program for income maintenance, it'll be the last of the industrialized nations of the Western world to do so. Really isn't a very new or novel proposal.
The guaranteed income could replace the welfare program as we know it today.
Oh, I think it has to. I don't think there's any question about what the welfare system has broken down. Here in New York City, where I live, everybody admits it. The Commissioner of Welfare admits it. I think this is generally being admitted in almost all of the places where I hear it discussed, that the welfare system is outmoded and has broken down. We have to do something. And the only thing that's being proposed that makes any kind of sense at all is to develop a system of income maintenance of one kind or another, and it's generally called a guaranteed annual income.
Doctor, we'll take our next call from New York City. Mr. Cantor is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mr. Cantor, good evening, sir.
Del, this is Mr. Peter Cantor. I would like to ask Dr. Carruthers what he thinks of organizations such as the Mayor's Committee, this is New York, the Mayor's Committee on Labor Relations, whatever, and also the State Unemployment Insurance, and various organizations like this and human rights, where they don't do anything and they're paid to do everything, and where something like the state unemployment insurance, every week you go down there, they'll ask you questions. When you're confronted with an out-and-out refusal, like I was refused several times, mainly on account of weight, they wouldn't even bother to even look at me. They only bother whenever they want to get their information, and I'd like his opinion on it.
Well, apparently you've had a
apparently
you've had some kind of a frustration, and I won't attempt to deal with that, although I'd like to express concern about it. But generally, for example, the mayor's committee on bargaining, the...
Not on bargaining, on exploitation of workers.
Well, I hear what you say, but I don't know of any committee on the exploitation
of
workers.
It's run by, one of the members of it is Mr. Otley, who you might be familiar with.
If you're referring to the Commission on Human Rights, it's done an enormous job. It's
not the Commission on Human Rights. I am referring to them, but they are only one of the things I'm referring to.
Yeah.
The mayor's committee is in the Labor Department. It's called the Mayor's Committee on the Exploitation of Workers. And basically the problem is with that, as with the two human rights commissions, that they're hamstrung by laws staying, limiting their power, as well as showing what their powers are. What my real complaint is with the state unemployment insurance, that the very same people who continually, every week that I was on unemployment, they continually asked me questions where I had been, and I had to wait long, long hours and everything like this.
Well, I know something about...
I didn't mind that. What I really minded was the fact that whenever I wanted them to do something for me and to try to see why such and such a company would not give me work and steadfastly refuse to give me work, which I knew I was duly qualified for, they just sat on their tuckuses and laughed.
I think I get the direction of your drive. On the state legislation on unemployment insurance and over the United States as a whole, one of the big problems has been that the federal legislation, which permitted this to go up to 39 weeks a year, was rescinded so that no state in the union that I know of goes beyond 26 weeks, which means that a man is off of that for a half a year. Now, if you run up against a situation where you can't get a job, if you're overweight or maybe you have a handicapped arm or a leg or something of this kind, then the unfair discrimination against the handicapped worker is one of the things that concerned me a moment ago when I said that one of the causes of poverty really is that workers who are either undereducated or suffering a handicap of some kind just don't get a fair shake. They're thrown on the junk heap, and we wouldn't do that with animals, but we do it with people. And I'm with you here on registering some kind of a national protest, and I think this is one of the things that the guaranteed annual income would help.
Definitely. I am for the guaranteed annual income. Number one, because I'm against wage slavery. I'm against the idea that somebody would have to be afraid to go attend his mother's funeral or something like that because he'd lose his job and everything like that. I'm against the idea of fat cat bosses thinking that they own people just because they're employees.
And I bet you're against not given a fair day's work for a fair day's wage.
Oh, definitely. I happen to work as a guard.
You got to balance it both ways, you know.
And a few months ago, one guard got shot. We just got a new contract. We only make $66. I'll admit that we don't do anything most of the time. But we're there, and we're giving our time up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cuckoo hours and everything else. And sometimes in one place or another, you don't get relieved. Anyway, that's all that I have to say. I guess there are a number of other people who are more intelligent than I am.
Thanks for calling, and good luck on it.
Okay.
Thank you for calling, sir. This is Night Cole in New York. Is charity out of date? Should our watchwords nowadays be faith, hope, and economic justice? And our guest tonight, Dr. J. Edward Carruthers of the Methodist National Board of Missions. And our telephone numbers in New York, our local number is 866-5010. And if you're calling from the East or the Midwest, you may call us at area code 212-749-3311. And if you're calling from the West Coast, it's area code 212-749-3357. Remember, Night Call is made up of people who desire to talk and people who like to comment with each other, so we welcome your calls. Dr. Carruthers, we were talking about the welfare program as we know it today. You said that it is becoming outdated. And I was wondering if most of the anguish that we have seen over the past few weeks here in New York being experienced and being projected by many of the recipients of the welfare program, is this a reason for their protest? Are they aware? Have they become conscious that the program is outdated?
Yes, and I think the humiliation of the enormous detail of casework, the red tape, the fact that, remember, we had a strike of our caseworkers here 18 months ago, I think it was, and they were loaded down. It was impossible for them to do a decent job with any of their clients. So I think, actually, the humiliation that these people suffer, the fact that they don't get the services that the caseworkers would like to render but can't possibly render, has got everybody in our area, but not just in New York. There are a great many cities where the same problem is seriously aggravated. That to be on welfare is to lose your sense of dignity and sense of real belonging to the community. You're an outsider. You're excluded from the mainstream of society, and you are made to feel like a sponge. You're made to feel like a leech. You're made to feel like an inferior citizen. Now, if in this process, finally, a person doesn't care any longer and finally just submits to it, then you've got a total loss of self-respect and self-dignity, and you've destroyed the personality of the individual. I think welfare, actually, is a wicked sin. I think we ought to get rid of it because of its wickedness.
In reference to the guaranteed income, should we only guarantee money for sustenance, or should we talk about guaranteeing also jobs and training and schooling and other methods to enable people to help themselves?
Well, let's put it this way, that you can't guarantee anything for anybody, because some people, there will obviously be some people who are sick and will waste whatever they come to and won't accept an educational opportunity, they won't accept a job opportunity or anything else. We're going to always have a small percentage of our people who are casualties, and these people will have to be cared for in a special way. They're always kind of a nuisance, but after all, they are people. Now, if you have a guaranteed annual income so that the family is not on welfare, it's not a second-class family. I personally prefer to put Mr. Rockefeller on it along with everybody else, Mr. Johnson or whoever gets elected president, put them on. We can afford it. We're going to put $33 billion to help the elderly in the next year beginning July 1st. We're getting over our heads into that side of the racket. Now, when you do this, you're providing a basic economic groundwork for the family to operate on. Everything they earn or keep, everything they earn, they can keep. I think in the South, this will be a motivation. In the economy right now, we do have availabilities that are enormous for education and job opportunity and job training. Right now, West Virginia, almost everybody thinks that West Virginia has no place for workers. There's a great shortage of workers in the coal industry in West Virginia right now, but the trouble is that the kinds of persons they need to work in the mines don't exist in the neighborhoods, because the machinery now required in a coal mine in West Virginia requires somewhat of an education and somewhat of mechanical skill. So I would say that if you get your guaranteed annual income, the resources of the community will move with it, so that you won't have to go into a great elaborate change of a lot of other factors in society. I don't want to press it as a cure-all, Dale. That would be too simple a solution, but it takes a long way.
Our guest tonight, Dr. J. Edward Carruthers of the Methodist National Board of Missions, calling in from New York. We'll return to our guest right after station identification. This is Night Call in New York. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Dr. Edward Carruthers after station identification. Monday night on Night Call, blacks, whites, and Puerto Ricans. Imagine for a moment that you're not only black and living in a ghetto, with all that implies, but that you and your parents are Spanish-speaking. you have combined within yourself all of the problems facing the black man, the Mexican-American, and the Puerto Rican. Perry Thomas is such a man. In a book compared favorably with Man-Child in the Promised Land, this man from Spanish Harlem makes you live with him in hell, says the dust jacket of Down These Mean Streets. And the New York Times reviewer called it a report from the guts and the heart. Speak for yourself direct to author Perry Thomas about his childhood, his drug addiction, his jail term, and how he made it up and out of Spanish Harlem. Blacks, whites, and Puerto Ricans, Monday night on Night Call. Speak for yourself, collect on Night Call from anywhere in the country to Dr. Edward Carruthers about faith, hope, and economic justice. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Dr. Carruthers, and this time we'll go out to Toledo, Ohio. Mr. Jardine is hearing Night Call over WCWA in Toledo. Good evening, sir.
Hello, Doctor.
Yes, sir. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. You've got a real fine program there.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you a question. One, do you feel or believe that the family unit, per se, in this country is the foundation of the country?
Well, it's one of the foundations. I think where the country is something like a bridge. It has several foundations. There's no doubt that the growing toll of America's broken homes is a serious problem. Right now, we have about 10% of all of our households with children are headed by women who are without a husband in the home. Now,
excuse me for interrupting, yeah. But what I was trying to lead up to, that if this would be symbolic of our country as a whole, in other words, without the family unit, the stabilization factor that we need, we're really going to be in deep trouble, whether it's in 10, 20, or 30 years, et cetera. I mean, we would agree on this basic philosophy at this point.
Yeah, then what I was moving to is when you get anything as high as that, and then when your statistics begin to show that the children from those broken homes tend to be the ones who can't quite function in the society along with others, as well as if they had had a chance.
Right.
Then you've got to admit you're in trouble.
Well,
on the other hand, there's...
Well, this brings me to my real question.
Yeah.
Why is the government pursuing the philosophy, the doctrine, and the legal procedures in terms of equal employment of men and women to the degree that men are being excluded from jobs in preference to women? Now, I'm not opposed, don't misunderstand me, that women should work or be able to work,
yeah,
but not at the exclusion of breaking down the family unit, where women, again, not picking on widows or divorcees in those extenuating situations, but where women would actually perhaps have a job before a man that heads up a family. Are we not decaying our society? It's just a matter of time.
Well, I think the general public is confronted with a cruel dilemma here. Now, these women that are heading up families have to work to support the family. So if a married woman whose husband is gone is trying to support a family, she ought to get the wages, shouldn't she?
I agree. I'm talking about women whose husbands are working, and granted, if they're working at $3,000 level income, she's supplementing their income.
Yeah.
But if the husband's making, and I'm not trying to set the pattern, I'm just making a general figure, if he's making, say, $8,000 a year, and then she's pulling in four, that's $12,000. But the point is she depriving another man of a possible job?
She may be, but you can press this thing too hard. Right now, we've got a worker shortage in this country, and it's my judgment that as we proceed with technology, that we are going to have a job shortage all the way across the board for generations to come. So I don't think we've got a job shortage, and I don't think we're going to have one.
I see.
So I think we've got enough places for everybody that wants to work, that they can have a job.
I'm glad you said wants to work.
Yeah, I think that, well, I don't think that all people want to work, and lots of days I don't want to. I'm sure that many days you don't want to.
I've got my days.
Some people just stretch out and get more days out of it. But The idea that women should be paid less or should be denied a job, I think, would be repugnant to the American public. I don't think you could get it done. So I don't believe, however, that working women can be called homebreakers. The statistics would indicate that children in a home where both parents are working do just as well as in the home where the mother stays at home. Isn't this awful?
it's a dilemma for the individual that doesn't have the information available that you have available.
Well, it contradicts our feeling that the woman's place is in the home, but actually the statistics are quite good that if the mother's working and the father's working and the children know it, that the children participate in the family as a pattern and are stabilized somewhat by the general satisfaction the mother gets from holding a job.
Right. Last thought, only take about 15 seconds. Among many friends, I mean, I happen to be white, so all I'm trying to do is state, among many friends, they don't seem to object in a real strong fashion about minority groups, regardless, I mean, Chinese, etc., moving into a neighborhood if they would be assured by authorities, agencies, governmental, state, local, etc., that these agencies are trying to make these people aware that they will have instant, not just responsibilities 6 months from now, but immediate responsibilities, if you will, when they assume the role of a middle-class neighborhood image, that they're going to have to change their habits, as well as people are telling us, the government, that we've got to change our attitudes towards people. These people are going to have to be educated in an area that they've got to change their attitudes, their previous ways of living, their hygienic habits, etc.
Now, I don't want to make you mad because you sound like a man I'd like to have as a friend, but what I'm going to say is pretty nearly an insult. Are you ready?
Right.
I'm talking right now from the 29th floor of an apartment house in the middle of Manhattan, and we have a small house with only 480 families. I've accommodated myself to every cultural habit and pattern there is, and within a block of here there are 7,500 families in this apartment complex. And we have accommodated to each other. And I'm thankful that they've accepted my cultural and habit patterns, although they're not the same. And I think that because you live in Toledo, you haven't had to face the fact that we are a pluralistic society, and we're going to have to accommodate to each other, and that we can't say to a man, if you come into our neighborhood, you act like we act.
No, not necessarily act like we act, because it's got to be a bending on both parties. Notice I said that we are being asked and told in some instances to change our attitudes, and I have a small common denominator with you because I'm originally from New York.
Well, you know what I'm talking about then. I think that we don't have a wide enough tolerance for differences of behavior patterns.
Granted, so we need a greater communication.
That's right.
Between the people, but we also need an understanding that it can't be change all on one side. It's got to be an interaction of change.
You know, it just might be that somebody would come out in your neighborhood that likes to sit on the front porch in a rocking chair and go fishing with a cane pole, and it might be a good idea for you to take up the habit.
Well, that's very possible.
I think we could learn a lot from the people who sit on the front porch in Appalachia.
Right.
It makes more sense sometimes sitting on a commuter train to go in to make a lot of money.
Well, there's no question about it.
I think we can learn more from the poor people than the poor people can learn from us.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Mr. Lee is calling in from Louisville, Kentucky. He's hearing Night Call over WLRS-FM. Mr. Lee, good evening, sir.
And Mr. Carruthers?
Yes, sir.
I understand from what you said tonight that you are in favor of the guaranteed annual wage.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard a great deal about this, and I've had a terrific time understanding the philosophy behind it. I cannot understand the thinking that says one person has a right part of my earnings.
Well, you know, I think it does have, though.
Why?
We belong to each other. We live on the same planet. It's a little spaceship. I'd rather be the one who gives than the one who has to take.
Well, I believe in helping people who are unable to help themselves.
Well,
but we've had a situation here in Kentucky, as an example, the tobacco farmers.
Yeah.
They've been unable to find people to help harvest their crops. They've gone down into Appalachia, but they can't get people to work because they're receiving welfare.
I harvested Kentucky tobacco once, and I don't blame those people for not wanting to work in those tobacco fields at the wages they get.
Well, you mean $1.75 an hour?
That's not a living wage.
Well, I don't know.
That's poverty money.
Sir?
That's poverty money.
Well, if I didn't have a job and was unable to find any other work, I'd certainly take that.
I'm not sure you would.
Yeah, I know
if
I would.
If you had a family of four, $3,000 a year, and you only get that during the season.
Oh, that's true.
You only get it for a few weeks, and then you're on the rocks. And they leave you on the rocks. I know that country down there. I went to college in Kentucky, and I think that the plight of the agricultural workers, they can't organize under the NLRB. We've got a terrible situation with regard to agricultural workers in this country.
Well, how about industrial workers? A number of firms have surveyed the area around Harlan and that general area.
Yeah.
But they can't find people who will work.
I know that's the case. We've got some projects in Kentucky, and the explanations of why they won't are very, very complex. But I think that one of the best things that could be done in Kentucky would be for some people like you to get into a community and talk to the people who won't work if they will talk to you. They may not at first. We had a hearing in Kentucky and got a long hearing with some of the poor there, and when they told us what they were going through, it's easy to understand why they just won't.
Well,
I think you've got
work?
A problem down there that you can analyze.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much. We come to that point in our show when we are always sad because we can't take any more calls, and just before we return to our guest, Dr. Carruthers, we'll take a moment out to give you a word about next week's guests.
Next week on Night Call, a black Puerto Rican, a white civil rights priest, a Zionist rabbi, a socialist presidential candidate, and a radical Episcopalian minister. Monday, Perry Thomas on Blacks, Whites, and Puerto Ricans. Tuesday, civil rights leader Father James Grappi on open housing. Wednesday, Rabbi Mark Tenenbaum of the American Jewish Committee on the Middle East crisis. Thursday, presidential candidate Henning Blomain of the Socialist Labor Party. And Friday, the Reverend Malcolm Boyd, radical Episcopalian minister, author of Are You Running With Me, Jesus?, a Yale fellow this year, on dropouts from the American Dream. All this next week on Night Call. Again, Del Shields.
Dr. Carruthers, we want to thank you for being with us, and we have just about 35 to 40 seconds, and where do the poor people go from here?
All right.
Are you there, sir?
I'm here.
Yes, I was
you
asking.
You've got that much time left. You've got 20 seconds now. Where do the poor people go from here? They better get organized. Organization of the poor to seek their own solution is the basic responsibility of the poor, and I think the basic responsibility of the prosperous is to help the poor organize to seek their own values and to seek their own decisions about their own destiny, and I think we're making a great progress in this area.
Dr. Carruthers, thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call.
Pleasure, Del.
Thank you. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Monday night, same time, same station, Blacks, Whites, and Puerto Ricans with Perry Thomas, author of Down These Mean Streets, Growing Up in Spanish Harlem. Listen Monday night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.